Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent with Media General Newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table guests, I'd like to remind you of some upcoming events. On June 28th, next Tuesday, we have Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the exiled president of Haiti, who will discuss efforts to restore democracy in Haiti. On Wednesday, June 29th, Mac McClarty, the White House Chief of Staff, will be here. And on Thursday, June 30th, actor and author Kirk Douglas will talk about the narrowing gap between fact and fiction in both the movies and the news media in a speech entitled Make Believe Versus Reality. I'd also like to mention that we have a book and author wrap session coming up on Tuesday, June 28th, with author Christopher Buckley, who certainly with this crowd in the room, you might want to come hear him. He is the one who wrote the book, the novel, the satirical novel, Thank You for Smoking. Audio and video tapes of Press Club luncheons are available through or by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards provided for you at the table and pass them forward, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd like now to introduce our head table guests. I'll interview them later, and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right is Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar of Knight Ridder Newspapers, Susan King, a broadcast journalist, Tom Brazidis, the Washington Bureau Chief of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, David Elwood, Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at the Department of Health and Human Services, David Swit, publisher of the Food and Drug Letter, Mary Jo Bain, Assistant Secretary of Administration for Children and Families of the Department of Health and Human Services. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, we have Susan Spaulding of the Daily Oklahoman, Bruce Reed, Deputy Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek Magazine and the member of our speakers committee who arranged today's luncheon, Doug Turner, Washington Bureau Chief of the Buffalo News, James Brosnan of the Memphis Commercial Appeal, and Vanessa Gelman, Knight Ridder Newspapers. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Today, we are pleased to have with us Donna Shalala, Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. In what no doubt will be a rock'em sock'em final few months of the 103rd Congress, the two biggest issues, health care reform and welfare reform, fall under the purview of Secretary Shalala's department. At our podium, we've heard extensively, some would say ad nauseum, about health care reform. And while Congress still is locked in hand-to-hand combat to produce a health reform bill, Ms. Shalala is here today to talk about the President's latest proposal for welfare reform. Mr. Clinton promised in his campaign to end welfare as we know it. It was one of the key issues that purportedly differentiated him as a new Democrat from the liberal Democrats. The crux of the President's plan is to require welfare recipients born after 1971 to find work within 2 years of accepting welfare benefits. And to help them gain the skills and education to get those jobs, the administration proposes a $9.3 billion package of training programs, child care, and job subsidies. The plan has been faulted by the left and the right for falling far short of the President's commitment to end welfare as we know it. Already, Republicans have started airing radio commercials calling it one half joke, one half fraud. They accused the president of increasing cynicism by overpromising and under-delivering. Donna Shalala has stepped into the fray by condemning conservatives for understanding the problem but not coming up with, but with coming up with the wrong solution. Teenage parents, she has said, should be responsible for supporting their children, but it makes no sense to cut off their benefits. A report released yesterday by an independent research firm warns that government programs designed to break the cycle of welfare dependence among young mothers are failing to discourage repeat pregnancies, and they do not lift a significant number of women out of poverty. Yet today, nearly one in three births is to an unwed mother, and some social scientists have called illegitimacy the single most important social problem, more than drugs, crime, poverty, illiteracy, welfare, or homelessness, because it drives all of them. It no longer can be ignored, but it certainly is questionable whether Congress can be expected to pass welfare reform this year if it is also going to pass a health plan. Here to talk about the prospects for the president's plan is a woman known as the little engine that could of the Clinton administration, Ms. Donna Shalala.
Thank you very much, Gil. Thank you very much to Gil Klein for that very gracious introduction. I don't know quite whether it was quite as good as the one I got the other day. I went to visit a school, an elementary school, Dick Riley and Ellen Haas from Ag, and I went because we're changing the nutrition requirements for elementary schools, and we went to eat with an elementary school group, and I got there early, and so I wandered into a classroom, and the teacher looked up and she said, "Children," she said, "this is a very famous person." One of the kids looked up and said, "Yeah, what channel is she on?" I'd also like to thank Eleanor Cliff for organizing the luncheon and giving me this opportunity to talk about the important issue of welfare reform and about the president's recommendations. It's not just welfare reform, though. I'm really here to talk about the future of our country. The future of our country is a young couple in Cleveland forced to separate, probably, because the husband's meager income disqualifies them from welfare assistance if they stay together. The future of our country is a battered wife huddled in an emergency shelter in Miami, and her choices are just as vicious. She either goes back to an abused husband or she enters the welfare system. The future of our country is three kids in New York who rarely see their father, but they know he doesn't provide any money to their mother. The future of our country is a 15-year-old girl in Omaha who's a victim of rape. The future of our country is a young mother in Racine who had a good paying job, but the job didn't come with health care. And when her baby got really sick, she had to swallow her pride and leave the job and get into the welfare system to get access to health care, to the Medicaid system. And the future of our country is a 15-year-old girl in Chicago who's being pressured by her 20-year-old boyfriend, so-called boyfriend, to throw away her future to satisfy his sexual desires. The future of our country is full of too many of these stories. The future of this country is full of despair for too many Americans. And I think full of hope for too few. In Kansas City, a young woman by the name of Yolanda McGee has hope and a future. She's a former welfare mother, and she stood with the president in her hometown last Tuesday, and she told the entire nation that she saw the welfare system, and in her words, it should now be a stepping stone, not a way of life. And the future of our country is also not only that young woman, but also the young people that I met at an alternative school a couple weeks ago in Los Angeles, and last week at the DC Street Academy, whose graduation I gave the commencement address at. Those schools provide that kind of stepping stone, that kind of second chance at an education, in this case, for students who've dropped out or have been kicked out of school. At the DC Street Academy, a remarkable institution, the student graduation speaker was a 20-year-old woman who described in her speech her determination to succeed because she wants to set a good example for her 2-year-old and her 4-year-old. That very courageous young woman who struggled to get her high school degree and all the graduates that I met that night represent the meaning of something the president keeps saying: we don't have a person to waste in this country. These students worked very hard to earn their diplomas. The road behind them was very rocky, but they didn't give up on themselves. And their teachers didn't give up on them, and we shouldn't either. In fact, I would argue that this country is a country that doesn't give up on its people. We are a country that believes in giving people a way up and second chances, while demanding at the same time responsibility and accountability in return. And that is the essence of the administration's bill, which was introduced 2 days ago by House and Senate leaders and the committee chairs, led by Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who of course is one of this nation's most brilliant and visionary thinkers on social policy. Last week, though, in response, Newt Gingrich said about our bill that we promised a Ferrari and delivered a Yugo. He's wrong on both counts. The Work and Responsibility Act of 1994, which is the title for the president's bill, is really a distinctly American family car. It's solid in design, it's economical in cost, and it's well equipped to begin a challenging journey to move millions of Americans from dependence to independence. There's room enough inside this welfare proposal to carry the entire family. Democrats and Republicans, liberals, moderates, and conservatives, businesses and schools, children and their young parents, and above all, working Americans. In fact, if you look at most of the legislation which is up on the Hill, you'll find striking similarities. Proof that the consensus for welfare reform now in this country transcends party lines. Both the president's plan and the major Republican plan emphasize the values of work and responsibility. Both make public assistance a transitional program leading to mandatory work. Both emphasize parental responsibility and delaying sexual activity, particularly for teens. And both provide funding for education, for training, for child care, and for job creation. And both recognize that it will require an investment of time and money to move young mothers towards self-sufficiency. And let me say now to those extremists who are out there, some of whom have apparently not even read this plan, we believe that work and responsibility represents a historic moment, that this act represents a monumental shift in this country's approach to lifting people out of poverty. Empower America didn't even get it half right. The bedrock assumption of our legislation is that work organizes and gives dignity and meaning to our lives. Our bill is based on American values of work and responsibility, which is exactly what 161 Republicans who are not extremists call for in their own welfare bill. And we're sending the strongest possible message to young women that they must stay in school, that they must postpone pregnancy, that they must delay having children until they're fully capable of raising them. Either the extremists don't or didn't read our plan, or they don't want to understand it. Because under our plan, it will be clear to every teenager, young men and young women, that having a child is an immense responsibility, not an easy route to independence. And from the very moment a young woman walks into a welfare office, she will understand that she is now in a transitional program leading to work. After an assessment of her skills and the training she's already had, she will, working with a case manager, design a personal employability plan. It's really a work and training agreement designed to move her into a real job as quickly as possible. She'll get help with job training, with the job search, and with child support, with the clear understanding that as soon as possible, she must work, preferably in the private sector. And we expect that many of these recipients will be working well before the two-year time limit is up. But after 2 years, if she has not found a job, cash assistance will end, and she will be required to take a job in our subsidized work program. And here, there's no question that our bill is tougher and actually smarter, I think, than some of the Republican alternatives. Because unlike traditional workfare, there's real accountability here. In traditional workfare, the welfare check is still the bottom line. Because it's so time-consuming, difficult, and bureaucratic to sanction someone who fails to meet their responsibility, in our work program, recipients will get jobs in the private sector whenever possible. And, as the President indicated, in the public sector only when necessary. And they will only be paid for the hours they've worked. And they'll get a paycheck, not a welfare check. Wages, not workfare. But let me also be clear about this. We passionately reject the more radical calls for abandonment of all help to young women and children. Charles Murray and Empower America may have gotten the problem right, but they got the solution all wrong. The draconian approach that they've suggested would end welfare, period. They'd abolish all forms of public assistance to young, unmarried parents, and they'd relegate their children to orphanages. Institutions that even a 19th century critic like Charles Dickens saw as abject failures. Their proposal actually sounds almost surreal. It's a 1994 version of Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal, which argued that the best way to deal with food shortages and overpopulation was to eat the children of the poor. But I don't think Empower America is being satirical. They are seriously proposing that the best way to deal with temporary dependency is to render people permanently destitute. That's not something that you'll find in the Book of Virtues. Let me repeat. Abandonment of responsibility by government or by citizens is un-American. It's wrong. It's wrong, and it won't work to cut off all benefits to the poor, particularly to single women and their children, even when they play by the rules and are willing to take part in education and in job training. It's wrong, and it won't work to create a generation of children who will grow up on the streets and who will have no reason, zero, to believe in the ideals of this country, including the most basic idea that hard work will be rewarded. And it's wrong, and it won't work for Murray and his disciples to advocate letting unmarried fathers off the hook, because that's what they do. They absolve unmarried fathers of any responsibility to support their children, the children that they help bring into the world. It's wrong, and it won't work to give up on parenthood and to bring back those 19th century orphanages. But that's just what Murray and Empower America would do. That's why we think that the bill supported by some extremists who embraced their approach could actually be labeled the Give Up on Young Americans Act of 1994. 70% of the people in this country in a recent poll have responded with a resounding no to the Empower America approach, while more than 90% in another poll agreed with the president's approach, emphasizing work and responsibility. And this support crosses all demographic lines, African Americans and Hispanics, Asian Americans, whites, from the Gulf Coast to the Midwest, from South Central LA to Bangor, Maine, across all income levels and across a broad ideological spectrum. There is wide agreement in this country that our plan takes the right stand towards truly ending welfare as we know it. Under the president's plan, we're dramatically shifting the focus of the welfare system from simply handing out welfare checks to preparing people to earn paychecks. Our push-pull approach combines supports and sanctions and economic incentives to help people who work hard and play by the rules, and to penalize those who don't. We believe that by strengthening supports for working Americans, by expanding the earned income tax credit, by requiring work, by guaranteeing health care with every job, and by providing child care, we will provide a solid platform for millions of Americans who are struggling to make the leap from welfare to work. And we will make a difference. We are not just tinkering at the margins. This is a huge effort that promises real, measurable results. By the year 2000, we expect 1 million people who would otherwise be on welfare either to have been completely off the welfare rolls or working their way towards independence. Our plan is as tough as it is farsighted. As Senator Moynihan has been telling us for more than 30 years, teen pregnancy, out-of-wedlock births, single-parent families are enormous social tragedies in this country. Unlike those on the left and on the right, who simply want to continue a very sterile debate, we want to meet the senator's challenge. We want to address these tragedies. We believe that holding teen parents responsible for the support of their children makes sense, makes a lot more sense than cutting off their benefits or maintaining the status quo. We're talking about fathers as well as mothers, because both parents are equally responsible. Our plan provides time-limited benefits to teenage mothers, but only if they meet several conditions. They have to live at home with their parents or a responsible adult. They have to identify their child's father. They must stay in school or participate in job training. They must attend parenting classes if they need them. And we're not letting young fathers off the hook either. Our plan goes further than any presidential initiative ever proposed on expecting fathers to support their children. Our plan says to deadbeat dads, if you're not providing for your children, we'll garnish your wages. We'll suspend your driver's license and your professional license. We'll track you across state lines. And if necessary, we'll make you work off what you owe. We know that there are men out there, many of them young men, who want to do the right thing, who want to support their kids, and who can't because of a lack of skills or because of chronic unemployment. And that's why, in addition to toughening the child support enforcement, this plan also allows states to extend support such as counseling, job training, and parenting classes to unmarried, low-income fathers, as long as they are taking responsibility for their children. These policy changes reflect our belief that given a little help, most men and women will rise to honor their responsibilities as parents. But in addition to requiring our responsibility, our plan also places primary emphasis on the prevention of teenage pregnancy. the link between teenage pregnancy and poverty is very clear. Approximately 80% of the children born to teen parents who dropped out of high school and did not marry are poor. In contrast, only 8% of children born to married high school graduates who are 20 or older are poor. We know that it'll take a comprehensive community-based approach to empower young people to delay sexual activity and parenthood until they're emotionally and financially ready. And we're absolutely committed to promoting abstinence-based programs in the schools as a key to preventing teen pregnancy. For all teenagers, for boys and girls, we believe that there's a crucial link between abstinence and aspiration. This fact really struck home for me last week when I read an article in a national magazine about a young woman named Catherine Mims. She's 21 years old, and she's a sophomore at Hunter, which many of you know is the CUNY college that I headed for about 8 years until 1988. The article described the remarkable partnership that we developed at Hunter while I was there, in which we gave dozens of teens something to say yes to while helping them to delay pregnancy. It's a very innovative sex education program. You'd have trouble finding the sex education part if you saw the parts of the proposal. Catherine, who was raised on welfare and therefore a very high risk, was offered a full scholarship to Hunter when she was very young, but she had to do some things. The deal was that she had to participate in the Family Life and Sex Education program of the New York Children's Aid Society, and she had to not get pregnant. Today, she supports herself by actually working in that program, working with other kids to keep them in school, to find them jobs, to give them a comprehensive health education program. And she continues to work towards her degree. In that program, we also worked with parents and gave parents a chance to have access to the City University, often to community colleges, if they finished their GED. It really was a partnership between the CUNY colleges and parents and kids in low-income communities. We believe in this administration that the Work and Responsibility Act of 1994 will help millions of other Americans, like Catherine Mims, to break the cycle of dependency and to start to build lives of productivity and independence. The President said that this is not a partisan issue, this is an American issue. There's a broad consensus on our approach to welfare reform, and any attempts to derail it have to be viewed more as posturing, really, than substance. It's a gross injustice to the American people that simply for political reasons, a small group of ultra-rightists would oppose what is a bold, centrist bill that is based on values that they argued for many years. At the same time, any embrace of the status quo is also an injustice because it's clear to the overwhelming majority of the American people that welfare as we know it has failed. It is also clear to the welfare recipients that welfare as we know it is failing. America's children, who are increasingly our poorest citizens, deserve a chance to grow up to opportunity, not to poverty and hopelessness. And the debate in Congress should be conducted with their futures in mind. The debate in Congress should be conducted in the true spirit of bipartisanship, a bipartisanship that has been so elusive in the past. We believe that we are one country, not two parties, and that all of us must work together to put people back to work and to revitalize our basic values, work and responsibility and opportunity and family. Thank you very much. Gil, I did here today, and I know you introduced them, are the three co-chairs of the Task Force on Welfare, David Elwood, Mary Jo Bain, and Bruce Reed, who did an extraordinary job. If there's anyone who was concerned about welfare that wasn't consulted with, it was only that our travel budget ran out for Mars. They have consulted with everyone in the world, I think. And they brought in extraordinary intelligence, and I think that the plan very much reflects their leadership and their own experience in this business for a very long period of time. The President and I both feel we were lucky to recruit them. I actually recruited two of them, and I tried to hire Bruce, too. I think I made you a job offer, too, by telling him this was one of those times in American history in which we were going to be able to take a step forward, and that they didn't want to just keep writing about this stuff. They wanted to take advantage of being here, and lucky for all of us, they accepted the President's invitation.
Okay, we have a lot of questions here. I'm going to start out. There are three here that get into where these jobs are going to come from. And I'll ask them all once, and you can answer them. How can you assure that enough real jobs are available for people with limited educations? Aren't these jobs disappearing? Exactly what type of jobs will be provided in the subsidized work program? And what safeguards are to keep your program from reviving the discredited CETA gravy train?
Let me say a couple of things about jobs and welfare recipients. First, it's interesting that a very high percentage of welfare recipients already have work experience. It's not that they haven't had work experience. And a high percentage of those who will enter welfare this year will leave the welfare system and find jobs on their own. 70% will leave in 2 years, 90% will leave in 5 years. So saying to a welfare recipient there aren't any jobs out there, they find jobs when they get out. The problem is that they cycle back into the system, that they can't hold on to those jobs or keep those jobs. And there are a couple of different ways to look at what we're doing. One is that we're changing the program to a transitional program, so it really is worker support. That by talking to welfare recipients, by looking at almost a generation of research, we know something about the job experience of welfare recipients, how important it is to assess them not to have cookie cutter experiences, so that for very young people who are under 18, for example, they must finish school. There are not jobs for people that don't finish high school in this country. But also, what they have said to us as they get out into these jobs. My opening remarks. The mother whose child is very sick. Of the people who left welfare last year, only 8% found jobs with health care. And so the health care piece, and one of the reasons why we have been very clear in this administration that health care must come first, it must be universal coverage, is because of the number of people who need health care as part of this, as part of the welfare package. Look at what the administration has done, though, to even entry-level jobs in this country. The earned income tax credit passed last year, which will take a minimum wage job for a female-headed household, a couple of kids in it, and raise it by 40%. In essence, we've actually remade the minimum wage job with the earned income tax credit. Add to it health care. A benefit package that will take care of that family, and child care, and you've actually remade a set of jobs in the United States to make them far more attractive. But in addition to that, we clearly are making an investment in education and training, assessing an individual's skills, making sure they have the support system to stay in those positions. We very much are focused on private sector jobs. If necessary, in a community where there are no private sector jobs, we will create some short-term, by that I mean not longer than a year, public sector supported jobs, which may well be in the private sector, in the nonprofit world. There are lots of useful things to be done. We've gone out and asked. We work very closely with the unions to make sure that we weren't stepping on anyone as part of this process. But I think both in making the job stronger and fitting with the needs of a family and putting together using case managers for these young teenagers to make sure they have the support they need to stay out there in the workforce, in putting time limits on so people really do have to stay focused. There are elements here that will help to move people to the workforce. And finally, let me say that when people talk about real jobs or good jobs, I'm the person whose hair stands up on the back of her head. As Tom knows, I come from a blue-collar neighborhood in Cleveland. Most of the people that I know that I grew up with don't have what you would call good jobs. I mean, they have jobs. They get up, they go to work in the morning, they support their families, they save some money, they try to put a little money aside, hopefully so their kids can go on from high school to get some post-secondary education. We have to be very careful as we use language. What we're trying to do is to move people, often without skills, to invest in them to get some skill development, to identify and help them to identify jobs in the private sector, expect them to stay there, and identify the reasons why they might come out of the system. Their child care fall apart, their health care falls apart. But there also are fundamental values here, that many Americans go to work in jobs that aren't upwardly mobile, and that it's important that we see as part of the value in the work ethic that getting up and going to work to a non-exciting job may well be as endearing an American value and experience as other kinds of things. So I don't want to overpromise, and we shouldn't as an administration, but we certainly expect the fundamentals that the president has outlined, and that is no America should be expected or should have to go to work every day and bring up their family in poverty. And we think that we've put a package of things together in what this administration has introduced: health care, the earned income tax credit, and child care, that will help to do that.
How does your plan encourage welfare mothers to get a job in 6 months, say, rather than waiting for the 2-year limit?
Ah, we put all the incentives in the right place, and that is one of the things that's happening now is that people are making rational decisions, and that is they're better off on welfare than they are in the private sector. They go into the private sector, there's no health care, there's no child care, they're at an entry-level job, and until last year, the earned income tax credit didn't kick in a way that made a difference. So the economic incentives, the pull part of this, are run in the other direction. The short-term public sector subsidized jobs will not have the earned income tax credit added to it. It will be more attractive for them to move into the private sector because they will be better off. The package of benefits will be better off. They'll make a little more. We're trying to change the financial incentives and the other kinds of incentives so that the private sector job and the elements of it are more attractive. The other thing we know from some of the research is for many people, bad experiences in school, getting to work right away makes all sorts of sense. But what we're trying to do is to change the incentives so that getting out is more attractive than staying in.
Don't you face an impossible enforcement problem converting longtime welfare recipients to work?
I'm not quite sure what the enforcement problem is. It seems to me when you shorten the period of time and when you focus, we're starting, of course, with the younger people, that we, in fact, will be able to get our arms around because we've cut down the load that we're going to deal with initially to those who have graduated over after 1971. But we've done some things, child support enforcement, making certain that someone can't be on a program in two states. I mean, we've done some things in this bill that will try to make enforcement and the elimination of waste, fraud, and abuse. We're going to count the number of months. We're talking about 24 months in a lifetime with obviously some exemptions for people who are severely disabled or other kinds of things, so that we really are putting limitations on that we believe are enforceable, but we really see this as an opportunity. And if the incentives run in the direction that you're better off if you get off the system. I mean, what would we say about a young mother in our society, the one that I described, who I actually happen to know, who has a minimum wage job, making a bit of cash, a little bit better off because she has a minimum wage job. She has no health care. and her child gets very ill. What is the responsible thing for that mother to do? I would suggest it's not irresponsible to go back into the welfare system and to collect Medicaid. So I do think that we have a way to get a handle on enforcement, and there's a big database that fits in with all of the things that we do.
Your welfare plan says that unwed teenage mothers should stay at home to get welfare checks. Why did you include that? Aren't there many home environments that are too damaging, and such as a child who'd been raped by her father?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there's just no way that we that in sending this message to teenagers that we would keep, nor would the existing system keep a young person in a family in which incest has occurred. And having a case manager as part of this is very important. In many, in some instances, the family, the initial family may not be the place where the young person should stay. It could be a grandmother. What we're saying is that teenagers should not be bringing up children in this country alone, that they should not move out and set up independent lives. The government of the United States ought not to be setting up a bunch of teenagers who have just had babies in independent households, that there ought to be a caring adult present, and that could be an aunt or a grandmother or some other kind of substitute. And that's essentially the philosophy behind this.
Are there enough caring adults out there who would want to take on, aren't there a large percentage of these kids who've been kicked out of the house?
Well, and many of them are living with caring relatives and live with someone from an extended family. And identifying a situation in which that young person would have the kind of support and simultaneously advice that that they need in raising that child would be very important. But remember that what we're saying is, as you take public money, we set the rules, and the rules are that we want you in a situation in which you have an adult supervision, that you are in fact a teenager, that the fact that you've had a child says that you have to grow up faster than everybody else because you have additional serious responsibility. But having a caring adult present will be very important as part of this this equation.
What are you going to do if the mother honestly doesn't know who the father is?
I think the states will be able to handle establishing paternity in all the cases where we possibly can. Obviously, in cases of rape or total irresponsibility, the state will make a decision. And what we do know is that 80% of the time, the father shows up at the hospital before, after, during the child's birth. So we certainly can go a long way towards paternity establishment than we've gone so far.
This questioner asks, didn't President Reagan propose the same sanctions against deadbeat dads 12 years ago? What makes you think your initiatives will actually work?
Well, he did make some proposals. This is far more comprehensive, and the result of the Interstate Commission, which Chris Dodd and a number of others were involved in, this is a much more extensive system. Which has a national element that will help us to track people across state lines. It also has a lot more consensus now in terms of holding both parents responsible. So I think there's a lot of bipartisan support for child support enforcement, and this is a piece that's going to be not only popular, but I think put in place pretty quickly.
This questioner says, most advocates for the poor, community action agency executives, and community-based organizations argue the two-year limit is a move in the right direction, but needs to be more individualized to be effective. Has individualization of the time limit been considered as an alternative to the strict uniform two-year limit? Will it be considered as the proposal progresses through Congress?
Well, I'm sure that Congress will have different views on a number of issues. I think that what you ought to see in this proposal is getting the values straight and then getting the policies that fit with those values. You know, I'm sure that the task force argued whether it should be 1 year or 2 year or 3 years. We see ourselves as advocates for the poor. This is not just because we landed where we did in terms of this proposal that we believe reflects both research as well as a pragmatic look at what's possible and how much of the states could absorb. We see ourselves very much as advocates for the poor. We also see ourselves as advocates for teenagers and as people that are experienced with teenagers. The first thing you learn about teenagers is get the rules straight and clear. And another generation of teenagers that get mushy messages from us about teenage pregnancy, about how long they can stay on the public dole, about what the responsibility is that they have to take in terms of education and staying in school and finishing their high school degrees at a minimum, about what's expected to them, and we'll lose another generation. So I think this is very much a part of getting the rules straight, and obviously we think that most people ought to get off before they reach that limit. We don't really see it as a minimum as opposed to a maximum, with lots of incentives running towards you'll be better off if you get out of the system earlier than 2 years. We also think that kids get young, both teenagers get the message, and adults will get the message that there's real opportunity here because of where we've put our investments.
This questioner says, while many states like Wisconsin are effectively utilizing waivers to institute their own reforms, the president's program appears to further federalize the welfare system. Republicans criticize your program as one-size-fits-all welfare program. How do you respond?
They didn't read it. You can't possibly read this program and say one-size-fits-all. It is, in fact, just the opposite. It talks about moving away from cookie cutters, so you sit down with the individuals just entering the system and design a plan for them that combines education and training in terms of the government's responsibility and what their responsibilities are. It leaves to the states a lot of flexibility about what to do with the young fathers. In fact, the states still can move their can move the programs around. The one thing that we do is we recognize the states have had very serious financial problems over the year, fully funding the jobs programs. And in this program, we really pick up a larger share. But I think it has enormous flexibility in it for the states. I think the states see it that way. They're not as enthusiastic about the financing that we came up with, but in terms of the rules and the values and the flexibility left to them and their ability to fit the program together to try new things with teenagers, to reduce teenage pregnancy, to design programs, community-based programs, bottoms-up programs, to get none of this will be dealt with unless there's a deep investment and excitement and I think creativity on the part of the states.
This questioner says, New York has a tradition backed by law of providing a backstop welfare financed wholly with state and local money. Isn't your program just going to shove federal obligations on state programs like New York?
No, I assume that's the home relief general assistant. Mary Jo Bain was head of the New York state welfare system. I doubt it. I mean, that's not the way that this is designed. I do not think that what this will do is shift costs to current state systems. In fact, the incentives here are for the states to really get into this because they will save money over a period of time by moving people into this new federal program, by rotating them off with good, strong, early investments, by taking advantage of federal money that's available. The incentives are to move people into the private sector because they won't have to use as much of their money. So I think that we've done everything we can to help to encourage the states to get this up and running. This plan also reflects a lot of the experimentation that has been taking place in states. Leave some things to states so that they will have the flexibility to design and to take advantage of new ideas that they have. But it very much reflects number of years of welfare waivers and in some ways institutionalizes some of the things that the governors and the counties have been doing for, wanted to do for a long time.
What is the realistic chance this is going to get to Congress to be voted on this year with so much to do in health care? Isn't it the fact that you probably put this out so you would have concluded the president's promise of proposing this and you're really going to take it up next year?
I don't think that that decision is ours in terms of the timing. We obviously would be delighted if we wrapped up health care reform this summer and then could move on to the president's many other initiatives that are out there. Both Chairman Gibbons and Senator Moynihan have indicated they want to take this up as soon as they have a window. What I think is more encouraging is their enthusiasm for actually stepping up and doing welfare reform as soon as they possibly can. But I don't think anyone can predict where this is going to fit in, other than it was very well received on the Hill, and I think that there's a lot of support to move on it as soon as there is a window.
This questioner asserts that behavior change approaches have worked poorly in such areas as drug abuse and AIDS cautions. What is the basis for your assumption that you can change the behavior that lead to teenage pregnancy?
Well, I think that because we start with a certain amount of humility about working with teenagers and with teenage and with teenage attitudes, and because we're willing to try a variety of different approaches. The fact is that we have had successful experiments and some success working with demonstrations, that we do know it's not just economic incentives and setting up rules, that it really is investment and opportunity, and as the president says, some things to say yes to, so one delays both sexual activity and most inappropriately having babies when you're the least able in your life to take care. And I think that a combination of very clear messages. Right now, we send young people very mixed messages, and it's not just everybody can blame the media. The government of the United States sends them mixed messages. Parents send them mixed messages. Leaders in our society send them mixed messages. If we can get the messages clear, if we can get the values straight, if we can get the program to reflect those values, if young people see opportunity as part of this. And I mentioned the Hunter program not only because I know it intimately, but because it taught me how complex all of this is. So if you enter this knowing that we know some things and there are other things we need to learn over time, and you're willing to invest in that, but simultaneously work is the center of this new transitional program, and responsibility is very much at its core. We think that we can, in fact, make a difference, and we're hopeful after years of trying different kinds of approaches. We also know that teenagers are the toughest ones to bite off, that that it may have been easier to go with older recipients in terms of what some people have suggested, but it's far more important for the future of this country that we start with teenagers. Look at the percentages of babies that are being born in this country every day. To poor teenagers, to young women who have dropped out of school, and you've got to see a future for the country. This is very much an investment in what the country is going to be like in the years ahead. And I don't care how tough it is, and I don't think the president cares how tough it is. The tougher it is, the more important it is to the nation, and that's why we really have decided to step up this time.
On the health care plan, what do you see as the compromise coming out of the Finance Committee, or will Democrats be able to push this through without bringing Republicans along at all?
I don't have a clue. I don't think anyone does. I mean, if you could find someone that knows the answer to that question. Let me say this about the Senate Finance Committee. Clearly, there is activity going on that's bipartisan, that is what is described as the centrists on the committee that are trying to work through a bill. Each committee in Congress has its own culture. I mean, they don't all look like America. They're not randomly selected. And each one has its own tradition. Senate finance, by tradition, has always tried to work out a bipartisan bill. That hasn't been as true on the House side. And so the way the House is moving is very much consistent with this tradition. From our point of view, we have laid down our marker. You can see it on welfare reform. Trying to get a generation of people off welfare very much is tied to our ability to put health care into jobs. Trying to convince Americans that government is fair, but most importantly, that when we do things, that we think about working Americans. Most of the people that don't have health care in this country are working. They're middle class. 55% of the people who don't have health care in this country make between $15,000 and $55,000 a year. They're middle class. They don't have health care. I think that all the committees have heard that message, and that's why they're moving along. No one's going to give up on this. And the fact that the Senate finance so-called centrists were willing to take the bull by the horns, so to speak, and see if they could work something out is very much, I think, in the tradition of that committee. So there's progress going on, and we're clearly pleased by that, but you can't see the end game yet. And the end game is not necessarily just what Senate Finance does. It's going to be a combination with a major debate on the floor of both houses. A big debate, which may well shape the politics in a way that we can't now predict.
Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Kessler seems intent on regulating tobacco as a drug. Do you think he will succeed?
I think that what Dr. Kessler has done is exactly right, and that is with the potential for tobacco being addictive. He has rolled out the issue, is laying out all the facts, not only before Congress, but before the American people, so that the decision that he eventually makes and that Congress eventually makes is a very informed decision that has had a lot of public airing. And I think the process is very much in the interest of every American and in the interest of quality decision making. So where he will end up and what kind of decision he will make and how Congress's decisions and their own legislation is going to be shaped, it would be inappropriate for me to say at this point, even if I knew precisely where I thought he was going to end up. But I like the process. I like the openness of it. It doesn't bother me that it's even taken some time to go through this, because I really think that it very much is in all of our interests.
Do you agree with Surgeon General Elders that priority should go to aid of the young, not to the cancer of the old?
I don't agree with Dr. Elders about everything that she says. That the position of the administration on cancer and on AIDS and on a variety of other diseases, and the position of this country, has always been that these dreaded diseases deserved as many resources as we could pour into them. Of course, this administration has a particular interest in the young. But frankly, we know enough about research on cancer and research on AIDS to know that in the process of doing that research, we're dealing with both the young and with the old. And so I think that she and I may disagree a little about the way in which she worded some of that, but the important point is that we're investing in both, and it doesn't have to do with age. It has to do with the nature of the diseases, the threats not only to this country but around the world, and the importance of this country's investment in biomedical research, and which ends up in determining the quality of our health.
We are, I'm afraid, about out of time, and so I'd like to present you, before asking the last question, with a certificate of appreciation for appearing here. And
what's the last question?
That's what you have to worry about. This is, of course, the National Press Club mug. You know I have two of them, so you can toast the passage of the welfare reform bill. And the last question is that Somehow you earned the nickname Boom Boom as an assistant housing secretary in the Carter administration. No one is quite sure what it means, but it has gone with you throughout your government and academic service. Where did that come from?
It actually was a name given to me by my staff at HUD when I was an assistant secretary, and by Pat Harris, who, and it was because of more because of my style of policy making, and that is that I didn't believe that you should just go at an issue in one direction. In the language of the 1990s, I thought you should vet it in terms of its political dimension, its public relations dimension, as well as an interdisciplinary approach. And they called it the boom boom strategy for policy development. I think it's very much reflected in what Mary Jo and David and Bruce Reed have done here, and that is we have taken into account not only what research we knew, but in the process of talking to people who both work in the welfare system, have been welfare recipients, are currently welfare recipients, and in thinking about the fitting of the values of this country with the government programs, sorting all of this out means that you go at it from different directions. And I think government and policymaking is much better made if you take your time. And I know we've been criticized, particularly in the welfare process, if you take your time and think through the issue from every direction, including how you're going to explain to people what you're trying to do. It is no surprise that we didn't start with themes like work and responsibility, nor were they kind of added on, but we started by thinking about the kind of values that we had as Americans and how our policy might reflect those values and what kinds of things had been tried, and then how we would explain it, what we were trying to do to the American people, and making sure that we put it within an appropriate context. It's a long answer to what I probably should have some silly response to, but it wasn't, it's actually not a, it wasn't a name given to me by Pat Harris in particular, because she was just sort of intrigued by the way I thought about issues. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNet Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.